We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. You know, there are a lot of businesses who have begun to use the internet to serve their customers. And certainly the government, the U.S. government and some state governments have done much the same thing, moving toward using the internet to provide information to people and also to connect people with government services. And it may indeed be the case that that makes it easier for some people to get what they need. It may also in the long run save government money, but there are people who worry that if we put more and more information online, we might actually shut some people out, or at least make it more difficult for them to access information. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about what is often called e-government. That's for electronic, e-government. And our guest for the program is John Gant. He is associate professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science here at the University of Illinois in Urbana-Champaign. And this whole subject of electronic government is one of his research interests, along with things like the adoption and diffusion of information technology and also management and planning of information systems. He's here to spend some time with us this morning to talk, and questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, so if you're local, use that number. We have a toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So if it would be long distance, use that one. And you may also email your questions to will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I think, as I said, as I sort of understand it on one level, when people talk about electronic government, they are talking about government agencies having websites and having information online so people can go there and download forms and they can look at rules and regulations and get questions answered. I think, though, that that people who do research in this area that you're interested in, though, are really trying to broaden that out and look at some questions and ask some questions about what does that really mean? What does it mean to that we're moving toward information government? Mm-hmm. Can we start there and talk a little bit about what some of the broader territory looks like?
Yeah, it's a really good question, right? When we think about e-government or electronic government, to date, it's really focused on trying to figure out more efficient ways of giving out information. We're also seeing a wide range of services online. You know, it's tax time. So the IRS, for example, is really at the forefront of providing citizens an easy way to pay taxes, even though you hate paying taxes. But and so that's another form of e-government, too, being able to take payments online and register for licenses, pay your taxes and things like that. When you think about government, government's a very information intensive type of organization. And actually, the government, the federal government, is the largest collector and disseminator of information in the U.S. And so, with the advancement in computer technology, you're trying to find more efficient ways of distributing this information. And the other big thing that's happening is just trying to figure out how do we digitize all these things that governments do, so we can try and do more of these things online and through computers and so forth. So it's going beyond just information and downloading forms, but also transactions like paying your taxes. And then the third is to try and figure out ways of enhancing people's participation in government as well, too, to be more involved. And so we're seeing a big change with that as well. Yeah.
Well, as we hear, this is maybe another big question, but I think it's kind of a key idea. And that is, as we become more and more of an information society, and in fact, it may be that the definition of that continues to evolve, what exactly that means. I think we sort of know what that means. But if we're moving more and more in the direction of being an information society, then is the nature of governing and governance going to change? And if the answer is yes, in what way?
Well, In theory, I mean, that's where different visionaries are, you know, see governments going as changing, you know, embracing technology in greater ways. But the other part of the story is that while we do have the technology, while increasingly more and more information is being put online and made available, the other part of the story is that we have to think about each person, each citizen, you know, not only as a citizen, but as a customer, as a constituent, as somebody who wants to be involved. And there's different levels of comfort. And so while government's trying to move forward, we also have to think about how do we design this in a way so that people readily accept and will use government in a digital form. And governance is changing as well, too. You know, governance, you know, saying how we participate, what information we have, how we can engage our elected officials and so forth is changing as well. I mean, there's the, you know, there's a lot of things that we see put together by the federal government to offer the information online, or state and local. But then, you know, we're also in an era now where we've got this Web 2.0 thing going on where people are just saying, you know what, I want to do it my way. You know, let me just have the data and make it available and let me, you know, participate in my own way. You know, let me form a community through my Facebook group, you know, to engage around different issues. And so we see, you know, that type of thing. And so so it's also being defined at the grassroots as well, too, as people are going to the web, they're seeing that all these different tools are out there. We see these communities forming and so forth. And people are saying, let me do it my own way as well, too. And so one of the big pushes with the Obama administration is trying to enable more of that to happen. And one of the big keys is this notion of what's called open government, right? And so the idea there is to say, you know, there's really three tenets, right? To create more transparency, more participation, more collaboration. So transparency is typically what we think about with government, you know, putting this information online so citizens can see what the different agencies are doing and, you know, information that's being reported can be used and so forth. You know, in terms of participation, try and make it easy to get involved. And with collaboration, trying to make it easy for people to work together and to, you know, be a part of the democratic process. And so that's the big change. So we've seen things like open government where we're seeing large amounts of data from each agency being made publicly available in open formats. And you know, and so that's what we're seeing. And with the idea is that, you know, as if I were a government leader, I can't say this, you know, this is what you should do. Instead, I should say this is what's available, and you can have the choice to look at it how you want to look at it.
Yeah. Let me just very quickly introduce again our guest, John Gant. He is associate professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at U of I, and is, among other things, interested in his work in electronic government and defining that as not just something like the internet being available for people to get information, but in a sort of a broader sense, talking about how information flows between government and people, among people, and how all of that is tied to citizen participation in, in government. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. As you've said, I think that the Obama administration has been more has been pushing this notion of open government, I think, more than anybody, any previous administration. And also, as you said, the idea seemed to be that government agencies should make freely available as much information as possible. So we're sort of going beyond the idea that I can go to a government agency and say, look, this is what I want. Tell me this. And then in however much time it takes, they'll get back to me. This is a different idea that says your government agency has a website, and the idea is that as much information as they possibly can put there, that's there, it's just there. So that then if I have some question or I'm interested in something, then I can go to the website and look at some sort of listing of what they've got and just go right there and not just have to ask for it, but it's just it's there.
Right.
So the administration, well, I think, in fact, was one of the first things that President Obama did after taking office was sign an order, sign a sort of a directive that said, okay, government agencies, we're going to expect you to construct these sites, put information there, and have it there. And, in fact, they set a deadline, which was, I think, early last month. So if we ask this question, well, how are we doing on as we sort of move toward this idea of trying to have this kind of open government, how are we, at least on the federal level, how are we doing?
Right. What's really interesting is that it's always been a responsibility of federal agencies and state and local governments to share information, you know, through the Freedom of Information Act. And what's different in the Obama administration is the idea of really ramping up the process for doing this. And so the big, you know, initiative is open government. And so part of the directive, as you you know, pointed to, is to require all the agencies to put their three most valuable data resources available on the internet, and not only just have them up there, but also have them up there in a very accessible, easy to use format. And also the second important tenet is also to be proactive, so that a person doesn't have to necessarily go to make a FOIA request to try and get the information, but to try and anticipate what information, you know, should be available. To ensure this is happening, there's a great deal of accountability in the directive that set timelines by when the agencies are supposed to have this information available, and the format very clearly defined in what accessible means, and not only just for all people, so even people with handicap accessibilities as well too, and also some sense of what quality information means as well too. And then there's some other language in the directive for institutional and organizational changes, you know, assigning a chief person to be responsible for this data to hold that level of accountability. In the early years, as governments put this information online, different agencies put this information online, there was no necessary accountability. You couldn't say, this is the person that's in charge of the data. And so one of the clear things with this is accountability, with assigning a chief person at a senior level to be responsible for this information. And another important thing that I think is it's kind of interesting to look at is they've got this dashboard where you can go online and you can look at these graphics, and it will list all the agencies, and it'll list the extent to which they're complying with this directive. And, you know, I looked at it a couple of weeks ago, and most agencies, you know, have complied at very high levels. But I think the benchmarks they're good benchmarks, but they're somewhat, you know, the low-hanging fruit type of benchmarks as well too. Mm-hmm. So it's a good step and a good first step. But I like the idea of having the increased accountability within the agencies to get this done.
Yeah.
And I also like the idea that more and more data is available. There's a portal called data.gov, which is a central resource where you can go and look for this information. And there's resources to help you understand how to use it and so forth. And another real important thing I've seen is that, again, there's different levels of use. A lot of this data requires some level of expertise. And so that can be a factor that really keeps people away from using the information. You know, I'm thinking of the census information. You know, right now, we're gearing up for another census. So everybody should start getting their forms, I guess, this month. And so here on campus, you know, my students are, you know, and other people on campus are heavy users of census data. And what I like about when you go to the census website now is that you can get all the census information right there. They've handled a lot of the technical issues of when you're looking at census data from over, from like comparing 1980, 1990, 2000. You know, there's some things that need to be done to make the data normal so you can analyze it over the years. And they've done that. But then what I also like is that they've got a big notice on there saying, you know, if you use this part of the portal, it's for more experienced users. Mm-hmm. And here are resources to help you to use it. So they've recognized that not only is it important to get the information there, but also to help the public learn how to use it. And I think it's a very important thing.
Yeah. And I think this is an important point, and it makes me think earlier you talked about the IRS and the fact that the IRS has this site. You can download all the forms. They have all the information on what to do with your filing your taxes. And I don't know if this is an appropriate kind of example, but that the fact of the matter is the information is there, but that does not mean that the average person looking at it can figure out what it is they're supposed to do and what number they put on what line.
Right.
So there still is this issue that in a lot of these cases, while the information is available, you might need to have some expert person be able to tell you what it means.
There's no question about it. Not only is the information there, but you do need this expertise. to really understand. And so I think that's the next level that we have to really think about is how do we build these kinds of capabilities so that it's easy. So if somebody is going to the IRS site, there's also customer service people or, you know, there's a website you can go to get customer service, and they have good quality service. You're not just to say, hey, it's on the website, call this number, email this address, right? Mm-hmm. Kind of the field of dreams thing. But, I mean, really think about it from a customer service perspective. And so I think that's the next, you know, important challenge. And I think not only is the problem, you know, difficult at the federal level, when you start looking at state and local government, which, you know, have resources that are even more constrained, an area where there's great underfunding or attention is thinking about how do we make this really accessible for our people that live in our local areas. And I think that's a big problem that's really not been addressed as well as it should be, you know, by this point. Yeah.
We have a couple of callers. Let's talk with them. The first is in Urbana and on line one. Hello.
Hi. Hi. I have a question for Dr. Gant.
Yes. Hello.
It has to do not with the flow of information from the government to us, but our accessibility of legislators. For example, at the local, well, at the state level, last week we wanted to send a fax, an email to each one of the legislators in the state. We find out that many of them don't have fax numbers. Mm-hmm. It's not anymore that there's no trace that there was one or whatever. And I was very surprised. I'm coming from Pennsylvania where it was normal routine to send them our opinion on, you know, issue X. Then the second part of my question has to do with also what you view as then as the influence of people when it comes to issues during the legislative process. It used to be, or even a couple of years ago, we were talking that what's the best influence we can give the legislator from the masses, not from the owner of X corporation showing up, at, you know, in the office, but regular people. We would say a regular letter has a lot more impact because it has to go through the mail, somebody has to handwrite it and the whole thing. But of course, word processors can reproduce those very fast anymore. There's all kinds of chain letters. Then there's the emails, and then there's the email that gets turned into a fax. And I find that when I go to different people, they give me different, you know, ratios of, well, if you send, you know, 10,000 emails, then you start to get a bleep on their screen. If we show up in their office, it's a hash mark. But how does it get weighed, and what is the state of e-governance from that side?
Okay. Yeah, excellent question. Go ahead.
Yeah, great questions. Let me address the first question. You know, this issue about accessibility to the legislatures, you know, at the state level. There have been a few studies looking at this, and I've actually reviewed, I think, three different studies on this particular issue. And at the state level, there's huge variation in how accessible the state legislatures are. In some states, like you're pointing out here in Illinois, it was very difficult to find the fax numbers. And in other states, not only is it difficult to find a fax number, but also an email address that's actually answered by a human person as well, too. You know, it's hard to believe this, but just, you know, 7 to 10 short years ago, in terms of, access via email, most state legislatures did not have an email address that was a personal address for the elected official. And so, you know, so what that means is that at the state legislative process, the use of email as a tool for communicating, you know, with the public is a relatively new thing. And part of the issue is, you know, I've done some interview with state legislators, and they, you know, they're saying, look, if my email is made public, I'm going to be inundated with email about different issues and so forth, and I need a mechanism to try and filter it, to try and understand it, try and figure out what's important, what's less important, and so forth. So there's been a second sort of technological change at the legislative level is the introduction of these what they call citizen relationship management tools, much like companies use for customer relationship management. So these are tools that essentially is a content management system or database where as your emails come in, they go into this database, they're tagged. There's you can read through the information that, you know, is provided by the constituent who's trying to email you, and it's tagged, so it's easier to filter it and that sort of thing. Then also letters, phone calls, any sort of contact are also recorded in this customer citizen relationship management type of tool. So that's how a number of legislators are trying to manage this. But then the second part of your question is so vitally important, is just I'm trying to get a message through, and if it's being put into this database, how do I know that my message is getting through, and what's the value of my message? You know, is an email as valuable as a handwritten letter or a typewritten letter? And I imagine, I know from my interviews that legislators have different strategies for trying to weigh it, and it kind of depends on the topic. I've heard them say, you know, it depends on topic, meaning if there are certain advocacy groups that are very strong and well organized around certain topics, they will discount an email, especially if it looks like a form email, more. But if it's a topic where there's more citizens are really concerned about it, less intermediaries, you know, like lobbyists or advocacy groups, and the letters look more original and so forth, then they'll weigh that as being a more legitimate concern as well, too. So, but each legislator kind of goes through their own calculus, you know, their own strategy for trying to figure out what's important and what's not. And as I said, these citizen relationship management tools, in a way, are equalizing all the different modes of communication, short of the face-to-face visit. So that's about the extent of what I know about that issue.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Let's continue and talk next with someone in Charleston, line two. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, my question is actually on a very similar kind of level, although a topic, but I'd like to ask you kind of maybe less about the details and more about the sort of bigger picture in terms of how electronic governance electronic systems might give the sort of individual citizens better access compared to those who can, donate a 5 or 6 figure donation to a campaign or something like that, which seem to have so much greater influence. Is there a way to use electronic resources to try to, you know, equalize that kind of influence? You know, if I'm not a lobbyist or a big donor, can I still try to, you know, get some sort of balance in that situation?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a very, important question. You know, it's clear that, when you're competing against lobbyists or advocacy groups that are, they're well organized and resourced. And so if you're just an average citizen trying to compete against that, it is very difficult. But there are some, I think, some things that are happening that we're seeing that are promising. As more and more information is made available, the one thing is that let's start at the federal level. When we talk about making data available, this is the first time that we're starting to see systematically across all agencies to make all this information available in an open, easy-to-use format that doesn't discriminate by the type of application that you're using. So you've got data resources that can be used with a spreadsheet. Of course, you need to know how to use a spreadsheet. They can be used in mapping software, but you need to know how to use the mapping software. But once you get past that hurdle, the data resources are rich. And what we're starting to see more is the grassroots efforts to try and have an impact on our elected officials is changing in the sense that communities are forming in other spaces. So like in, with Facebook or other social networking spaces, we see a lot of communities forming around different issues. The Twitter is another important tool for organizing large groups of people. And so we're seeing increasing uses of those tools and kind of a low barrier of entry to get involved. And so that's the thing that we're starting to see a great deal of. And I've heard lobbyists, be really concerned that, the biggest fear is a well-organized grassroots movement that uses these very inexpensive tools, like the social networking tools, the Twitters, and things like that, to bring folks together. And not only are they coming together, but they're coming armed with good research, good information, because of what's being increasingly made available. And again, like you go to sites like Open, I think it's opendata.gov, I think is a site, for example, where you can start seeing some of the data that's being made available and so forth. But, you know, with this said, though, there's great discrepancies, you know, across. Another area where I've, you know, done some thinking and work on this is with school districts. York, for example, right? And there, parents really want to be involved with local policies and so forth. So, and you've got the school board, you've got, you know, other lobbyists and so forth. And I've seen some local jurisdictions develop tools to really arm parents in the community with vital information about the schools, not just test scores and things like that, but financial information and stuff like that, so that they could come to the meetings armed with information and really advocate for, you know, positions. You're right. There's a big disadvantage, and I think increasingly we're seeing a leveling of that playing field, but it's still going to take time.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. We're a little bit past our midpoint. I have another caller we'll get right to. I would like to introduce again our guest, John Gant. He is associate professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. And among the things he's interested in his research, electronic government. That's really what we're talking about here, meaning the increasing use by people of things like the internet to get information, to get services, but also as a way to communicate with government, communicate with their elected representatives, as a way of organizing around particular issues, something that we are certainly starting to see more and more. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk, so that's W-I-L-O, will-talk at illinois.edu. And let us talk with someone else here, Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I wanted to get back to our own Illinois General Assembly. I was kind of surprised. I understand from the office of the clerk, you know, that they will record sessions of the House and House committees, but they don't record all meetings, say committee or task force level, or I'm sorry, commission or task force level. They may not even keep minutes. I thought I'd read somewhere that maybe the General Assembly isn't even necessarily bound by the Open Meetings Act. So it seems, although there's, you know, good possibilities for open e-government, if our own government doesn't make it available to the public, it fails. I wanted to know if you had any comment on our General Assembly in particular.
Yeah, I don't know the specifics of the General Assembly here in the state of Illinois. And I also, you know, I can say that the interpretation of what open government, you know, is varies, and really what it's focused more on kind of a data-driven sense of openness. And in the sense of what you're talking about with Open Meeting Act and so forth, you know, one of the big things that we're seeing, the big changes that we're seeing in terms of e-government is trying to make more of these meetings available online, so you actually will stream the meetings. Make those meetings archived, the videos archived, and so forth. And so we're seeing that type of change. But specifically what's going on here in the state, I'm not really sure.
They're not doing it. I mean, right, I've been right. talking to the office of the clerk, and they just won't do it.
Right.
And I understand they're making, they just recently passed a new rules for FOIA requests, but it's my understanding that they're trying to modify that mm-hmm. as well. So, okay. I mean, all this is a great idea, more open government, but it seems we have a number of people at a number of levels who don't want to make it any more open than it already is, maybe even close it up some. Anyway, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We do have here in the state of Illinois something called the Illinois Channel.
Right.
And
right.
this was an effort, and it's been in existence now. I'm not sure how many years, but I think the idea originally was to create something that would be like C-SPAN
right.
but with an Illinois focus. Mm-hmm. And so there would be things like, you know, the hearings and the proceedings and so forth would be there, so people could watch them. And then there would be other sorts of things there. There would be coverage of press conferences and and things that have to do with public policy. It would be, you know, if you know what C-SPAN is like, the idea would be, yeah, like that, but for Illinois.
Right.
And I'm sure that like anything else, the question is, well, what sort of resources do you have to put behind this thing? And I'm not sure how – are you much familiar with how that's gone?
Yeah, well, the resources for trying to do this is expensive. And so that's a big part of it. When you have C-SPAN or like the Illinois Channel, for example, those organizations are going in and basically working under FOIA requests to get access to these types of meetings and broadcasting them. But they are, you know, it is expensive, you know, to archive and that type of thing. But I think the previous caller was also saying, okay, once we get past the level of what we see like on the Illinois Channel, but because he specifically said task forces or commissions or these subcommittees, right, where a lot of the detail is sort of hashed out, that type of information you very rarely see in a form that's distributed like on the Illinois Channel, unless it's a very particular big issue. And that's where a lot of the, you know, a lot of the action of government happens, but it's not a level that is that falls away from public view as well.
Yeah. I'm actually here looking at their website. I have it up on my computer here, and they're just another organization that's out there trying to raise money.
Right.
They, in fact, apparently have a fundraising effort going. They're hoping to raise $1 million by the end of the year, and so far it looks like they have close to 44,000. So they have a little ways to go.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty tough when, again, what you're doing is you're asking people for money, particularly in a climate that we have now. And I'm not sure if in addition to this, they're also getting some state funding. Anyway, they have a website. So if people are interested in the Illinois Channel, you can and you have web access, you can go and check it out.
Right.
Questions again, welcome 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Here, as if government is moving more and more toward providing information in this sort of way and having this be an avenue for people, here I think, again, it brings us back to the question of the digital divide and the access to the tools for people to be able to do that. And, you know, maybe this is just a small – I don't know if this is a significant example. I was in a local business recently and was sitting there and somebody came in and asked for a job application. And they said, oh, those are online. I'm thinking, well, great. That's okay if you can get online. And I guess you could go down to the public library and you can do it that way. So it's not like there's, you know, no free access at all. But again, I mean, it brings me back to the idea that if this is going to be increasingly the way people are going to interface with government, then access becomes just an even bigger issue than it has been in the past.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up. Part of what I'm working on this year is looking at that particular issue. I'm in addition to, you know, being an associate professor at GISLIS, I'm also a visiting fellow with the Joint Center of Political and Economic Studies in Washington, D.C. And I'm working on a very specific project with them to look at broadband access by minorities, particularly because of this question, right? Because in my area of work, e-government is very important, but it's not – what's the point of e-government if people can't get online? And then increasingly, when you start seeing things like job applications being available online, and that's the only place that you can get it, but yet and still, I have slow access to the internet, and I'm trying to download a form. You know, that's going to create a barrier. So, in working with in collaboration with the Joint Center, you're familiar with the Pew Internet American Life Project. So this is a study that's very similar, but it focuses on minority adoption, particularly African Americans and Hispanics and Native Americans and Asians, and to really try and uncover that issue. And what's really interesting, when we look specifically at issues around job search and education, there's a big difference. There's a very big digital divide gap there. And what I worry about is that when you have things that are like media rich, like a PDF for, you know, an application first as a person even needs to understand, what is a PDF? What am I downloading? Can my computer handle it? And so forth. And it's a large problem, because when you start looking at job search by race and by income, what you find out that the folks that are, you know, the poorest among us, increasingly are going online to do job search. When you look in the African-American community, at those families with incomes less than $20,000, roughly 90% of the people that are on online are looking for jobs. And so it's a very high number. And so then the question is, if they're looking for jobs, where are they going online to get it? You know, if they're not doing it at home, to get broadband access, and so forth. And so that's it's a really big problem. And so increasingly, when you look at other benefits and services that are targeted for, you know, the poorest parts of our community, more and more of those resources are being put online. Mm-hmm. But those groups are the smallest users online, and they're the newest users online. So let's say, you know, they come to they get broadband at home, or, you know, for example, and they get online, then there's a whole issue of getting up to speed of how this whole online thing works. Yeah, I want to do this job application, but, you know, I go to the website and I got to figure out how to navigate and find the information on the website. Then I've got to fill in the form, right? And if I'm filling it online, is it saved? How do I know that the person actually is going to read my application? You know, you think about the day before pre-internet, or, you know, before electronic forms, you would print, you'd get the form, you'd fill it out, and you would hand it to the person. You would look them in the eye, you would shake their hand and so forth. But here you're sending it off electronically. And, you know, maybe for college students, people that have been online longer, they understand that and put a little bit more faith in that. But if I'm new, trying to get online, and, you know, this is I really need this job and so forth, and I'm sending it off, and, you know, I'm like, did it get there and stuff? And then tie into what an earlier caller said, and then I go and try and find the phone number and call. So do I call the main desk? Give me HR. Who do I talk to in HR? Did you see my application? You know, it just creates another layer of difficulty that's embedded. You know, that's part of this digital divide. So the divide isn't so much have versus have nots. That part is there. We're getting past that. But it's now saying, it's in more subtle forms of saying, are the applications designed well? Are people getting access easily and so forth? And, you know, our study was, you know, one of the first to really come out and further document, I guess, more dimensions of this digital divide. And so now there's a divide with getting good, fast speed access. And it's a major problem. And as you know, the university was awarded, I guess, a big broadband grant, yeah. Right? And so now there's an issue over the next 30 days to decide whether they will accept it or not. But again, that's trying to address that particular issue. That proposal is to build the infrastructure, and the part that was cut out was dealing with accessibility. So there's another group that's working on the accessibility piece for the second round, which is due in a couple of weeks. But that's still, you know, a pervasive problem. And it's going to be increasingly a large problem as, you know, you can see the story. As more and more information is going online, and it's information where I don't have a choice about it. So using YouTube, playing on Facebook and things like that, you know, that's discretionary. But when I got to find a job, I got to do my banking, I've got to get information, there's school information that's on there increasingly and so forth, I don't have a choice. You know, yeah. then we've got a problem.
Yeah. We've got 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is John Gant. He is associate professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science at U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. We're talking about e-government. At least that's what we started talking about. And, of course, you can see how easily we get into other kinds of areas. But, again, what we're talking about really is the idea that more and more people are going to use electronic means, and pretty much that means a computer and an Internet hookup, to get information from government, to get services, to try to communicate with their elected representatives, and then even go beyond that to do a lot of other really important things that maybe we used to do with paper and pen, and we're not so much doing it that way anymore. So questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Yeah, we have some other folks, I think. Next we'll go to St. Charles. on our toll-free line, line four. Hello.
Good morning, guys.
Mm-hmm.
How are you guys doing today?
Okay.
Good, thanks.
Okay.
You know, you brought up a lot of stuff, but just funny, it's kind of, long story short, I'm out looking for a job. Mm-hmm. I've been looking for over a year, and I got to tell you, doing it online is the most impersonal way of doing something, trying to, you know, interview somebody for a job prospect than I've ever seen, because they do hypotheticals, and it's just, you know, the stuff they throw up there for a psychological test and a hypothetical situation, what would you do in a certain instance, it's just so impersonal, it's ridiculous, because it's not really going to the focus. Instead of talking to somebody in line, you know, so going to the job spot itself and talking to somebody up front, an eye person, that's one thing. The second thing is I think there's a lot of information overload out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I do a lot of research on things, and I'm trying to find stuff. How do you know who's telling the truth?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for a fact, how do you know with all this misinformation about politicians right now, mm-hmm. and what's out there about them in general is truth, and you know what's the truth and what's fiction? Because you don't know. You don't know this person's writing all this information about people or projects out there. Are far-fetched, made up, or what? It's hard to find it, you know, where the information is coming from, mm-hmm. in general.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the scary thought, because, you know, I look at security. I look at all these people being tapped into, you know, viruses. By the way, I honestly believe if somebody wanted to go after us, they're going to go after us in the computer information age, because it's been a known fact that the Pentagon's been hit several times. I mean, and they have to keep changing it. So, mm-hmm. I mean, information could be good, but it also could be bad, too. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts on it. I'll get off and listen. Thanks.
Yeah, it's a good question. First, you know, I'm glad you shared your experience with a job search. You know, a job search is, you know, meant to be a personal thing. It's a stressful time. And you definitely want to be able to have that personal contact with the organization. But increasingly, one way of shifting costs is to put everything online, use computers to do more of the work of reading through the resumes and that kind of thing. And so, you know, a big part of what I do as a professor is, you know, I help advise my students to find, you know, find jobs. And I've got to keep up on what, you know, the changes that are out there. And so I can advise them in ways so that when they write their cover letter, or they're writing the resume, that certain keywords and things like that are in there so that the employer can really see, aha, there is a good match and that type of thing. And the problem is that you've got a computer doing the first screen as well. So, you know, I sense your frustration. I get the similar story when I talk with my students now, as they're out on this, you know, very competitive job market as well too. And then the second point about information overload, there's no question the net just grows so quickly. Added on there, you've got blogs, for example, where people can freely publish their own ideas and opinions and so forth. And what's challenging for any user, whether experienced or novice, is trying to figure out, is this legitimate or not? And so I think what's important is trying to figure out, is to have a good community of people that you can trust, that you can sort of, you know, talk to and say, hey, I found this bit of information. You know, take a look at it. Help me try and figure out if it's legitimate. I mean, there's obvious things. You look at the organization that's published the information. You know, is there a way to contact the person that's published the information? Can you verify that information from multiple sources? You know, sort of triangulate the information as well, too. And also, those sources should be legitimate sources, you know, like newspapers or recognized journals or magazines and things like that, to try and get confirmation of some of the ideas, you know, that you might be reading and so forth. And, you know, as I say, when I'm, you know, when I, you know, advising people when they're on the net doing research, is, you know, always be very cautious about the information that's out there. And, you know, there should be citations if it's, you know, if, you know, that you can should be able to follow up with verify the information as well, too. So that's where. So what I'm seeing is that as the internet is growing in terms of the amount of information, as a consumer of this information, I think you have to build relationships, like with your library, like with your friends, like people in your community, and so forth, to do further vetting of this information as well. I know that my family's online, and it's fascinating to see my mom, my dad, aunts, uncles, and so forth. And, you know, I get questions and calls from them. You know, they'll get this virus, and I'm like, oh, you know, that one came out 5 years ago or 10 years ago, but they're new. And so that, but that's an important way of vetting this information. I think that's what you got to do. And so I think you can't go out there alone. You need to have a community with you as you are out there on the internet.
Yeah. We have about 5 minutes left here with John Gant from the Graduate School of Library and Information Science here at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. To pick up on something that I think the caller hinted at, another issue is and this, again, is not a new issue. It has to do with privacy.
Yes.
It has to do with the ability of the government to look over your shoulder and see what you're doing. And if what you're doing, the way you're interfacing now with government more and more is going to be online, then it seems that that would make it easier for government to keep track of people, what they're doing, what they're looking at. Very easy to catalog all the various sites people are looking at, what kind of information that they're looking at. And then, of course, then there's also the question about the inability of some third party to get in to have access to that too. All very serious questions. Anytime you do anything online, obviously that's a serious question.
Yeah, it is a serious question. You know, recently, you know, Google, when the news came out that Google was actually hacked allegedly by people from the Chinese government, that was the allegations, and they've pinpointed to the hack coming from a couple of different universities. But that opened this whole discussion up about this relationship between government and the large behemoth organizations that are collecting this information. And after that, Google turned and went to the National Security Administration for advice on the security of their systems. But just that conversation, when it became published, really raised so many red flags in the minds of so many citizens saying, wait a second, NSA is going to take a look at Google data, you know, what Google has. We don't know the extent of the relationship, but it raised a lot of alarms saying, can an organization like the NSA look at this, look at their databases? And Google has very rich, you know, resources. So that really raises the question as well, too. What's interesting, when you go and visit government websites, there are very strict policies to limit the ability to actually track a person when they're on the website, you know, with cookies and things like that. Mm-hmm. But still, it's a long-running tension that has always been there about what are the boundaries for government and are they going to, you know, respect that? This has come up actually in thinking about other issues, even outside of the United States, with like the earthquake in Haiti, for example. One of the things that my class is working on is developing an e-government plan for the country. And one of the big things that comes up as a barrier to getting folks to use, especially in times like this, is the privacy question. And the question of, you know, are people getting too many resources? You know, is there corruption and things like that? And so this privacy thing is a thing that really limits the desire for people to want to use e-government and so forth, because people want to remain on. I've done work in Korea, for example, where to use local government websites, you actually have to get a membership. So you do sign up, and they know everything that you're looking at. But it's a different culture.
Yeah.
But even in that culture, they're saying, well, wait a second, they don't need to know everything. I'm just browsing for information. You know, if I go look for public health information, they don't need to know that. And so it's a big problem.
That was we're coming down to the end here, but I think that was really interesting because I came across a ranking by the, I believe it was the United Nations, mm-hmm. ranking countries on how they're doing in mm-hmm. terms of e-government. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, the top ranked nations are Sweden, Denmark, and Norway. Mm-hmm. United States comes in at, I think, number four. Mm-hmm. South Korea, and this is why it sort of struck me because I know you had done some work there, also comes in pretty high. It comes in at number six.
Right.
And that made me wonder, well, by looking at what other countries are doing, particularly those who get high marks for moving in this direction, can we learn anything interesting?
Yeah, we can. You know, when you look at the countries that are at the top of the scale, those are countries that have very strict laws on privacy. They do a lot to protect the privacy of citizens. And so there, I think you see even more robust e-government type of applications, stronger methods for identifying a person when it is required to do that. And so, you know, the Scandinavian countries, for example, tend to score very, very high on there. It's a culture that has really embraced the internet well. And part of it is that there's a great high level of anonymity when you are visiting the different websites. You know, I got to meet most of the e-government architects for the top 30 countries in some work I was doing. And that was one of the biggest things that they cited as the reason why. you know, the sense that the public feels like they can go and use these sites without restriction. And so that has created even more fertile ground for more enhanced development of e-government type of sites, where there are where citizens sort of feel like government's big brother. There's greater restrictions and tighter controls over the money, tighter controls over the creativity of what's being permitted and so forth. You get citizens sort of raise their hand and say, wait a second, we don't want you to do too much. And so I think that has that's an important driver for the quality of e-government services that we see.
Yeah. Well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish up. I think we've gotten a lot of interesting areas, and I'm sure that there's much more to be said. Any sort of last thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
Oh, well, I'm really glad that I had this opportunity to come and talk about this. This is, you know, in a very important area because increasingly as we move forward, we're going to see more and more services online. I, you know, think that much more attention needs to be paid to the citizens, trying to make sure that there's fair access, you know, like with broadband and so forth. And then as more and more people are getting online, I think each person needs to come armed with their own community. So I think, you know, we have to help each other. You know, for the more experienced folks, find some newbies out there and say, hey, you know, how can I help you learn, help you do this and be really smart and savvy, you know, about working out there. I think there needs to be more resources for training and accessibility. You know, available within the community as well. You know, part of what we're thinking about with, you know, the big broadband is how do we, what are good models for that? And Champaign, you know, they're thinking ideas of these cyber navigators where you can go to the libraries. And there are a group of young folks that are all, you know, immersed in all this that can just sort of help anybody out and, you know, on the net and so forth. So I think, you know, we have to do more to try and really enhance that so that more and more people can get online and really take advantage. There's some folks that just aren't going to do it. But for those folks who are trying, you know, I really want to see us do more to really help those people out.
Our guest, John Gant, he is associate professor in the Graduate School of Library and Information Science here at U of I. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you.